High stakes on the DMZ, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. In just a few hours, the leaders of North and South Korea will hold a summit, the third between the two nations.
There's huge symbolism here because I think what they're trying to convey is a whole new era is happening.
Except this new era is also a more dangerous one.
North Korea now has a credible nuclear deterrent at this point. We don't know how strong it is, but it is there, whereas in prior summits, that did not exist.
Plus, a Swedish visitor to Pyongyang notices something odd, a bunch of vintage Volvos on the streets.
This was like traveling back in time. I mean, the cars were still old, but they were very mint condition. They looked well kept.
How did they get there, and why? Answers ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. This is a big moment on the Korean Peninsula. In just a few hours, the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, is scheduled to step across the heavily militarized border that divides North and South. Philip Yun is a former State Department diplomat, and he knows what it's like to cross that border and meet North Korean officials face to face. Yun's with the Plowshares Fund in San Francisco. Plowshares has been a funder of our program in the past. Philip, tell me about your first impression of the North Koreans. You were part of the U.S. delegation that went to Pyongyang in 1999, and I understand you shook hands with officials, including a high-ranking North Korean military officer.
Yeah, I had met North Korean officials earlier in New York when we did some initial negotiations in 1998. And interestingly, in the middle of those negotiations, the North Koreans chose to launch their first long-range missile in the middle of those talks, which made things very, very tense. Subsequently, after a number of other talks, I was actually in North Korea with William Perry. That was part of what was a U.S. review of U.S. policy towards North Korea called the Perry Report, and subsequently became the Perry process. So, yes, I went to North Korea at that time, met a North Korean official who was in the Ministry of Defense, and he was sort of the head of that, a senior colonel who was the head of the organization and the secretariat, the one that sort of administers. And he made it very clear to us that he was there only because Kim Jong-il, who was then alive and the leader, ordered him to meet us. Otherwise, he would not have done so. And when we walked in, we all shook hands. But I noticed that he shook hands with me both times as we went and left a little bit longer. And for me, he stared into my eyes and it brought back all these childhood memories. For me, when I was growing up, I had a babysitter and when I didn't behave, she was saying, if you don't behave, evil North Korean soldiers are going to come get you. And so I grew up with this whole notion of a North Korean boogeyman who was all powerful and evil. And when I shook this guy's hand, I kind of felt that because what I was feeling from him was, you're a traitor to the homeland. You're Korean, and yet you're here with these Americans, and how dare you?
That sounds a little chilly. Do you expect that kind of suspicion to be at play tomorrow when these two men meet?
Probably not. You know, I do think there is going to be, publicly at least, you know, a lot of smiling, shaking hands. I wouldn't discount that there may be some people who are not in agreement with what is happening here, probably on both sides. So maybe at a different level, there may be this level of sort of hostility to some degree that is conveyed in some fashion. But those are things that cannot be helped. But I think overall what you're going to see is a lot of smiles and a lot of handshakes and a lot of hope.
Now, this summit tomorrow is going to be full of symbolism. Apparently, it's being meticulously managed down to the smallest details. What do you think is most important about the symbolic meaning here of these two leaders shaking hands and speaking directly?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because I think what they're trying to convey is a whole new era is happening. What we have, this is going to be the third summit. There were two other summits prior, but this summit is different in a number of ways. First is we have two new leaders. The previous two summits, Kim Jong-il was there. And so now we have two new leaders who I think they're trying to say, let's turn the page. The second thing that's new about this is that this meeting is actually happening in South Korea. It's happening in Panmunjom, but they're going to cross the DMZ line, the actual line, and the meeting is actually going to happen in South Korea. And this is actually quite positive because there were prior commitments in the previous two meetings to summits that the North Korean leader would come to South Korea, and for a variety of reasons, Kim Jong-il never came. So him coming to South Korea is really great. And a side issue, and this is pretty significant, that's not being lost, I'm sure, on the South Korean people, is that the outward security for the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, is being controlled and taken care of by the South Koreans. Now, Kim Jong-un's immediate bodyguards are going to be there, but the outer security rim while they're there is going to be taken care of by the South Koreans. And then finally, this particular meeting is happening very early in the South Korean president's term. The South Korean president has 1 5-year term. And so because of that sort of idiosyncrasy, there's a tendency for South Korean presidents to become lame ducks relatively early. And so the last two summits were happening relatively late in the terms of the previous two presidents, Roh Moo-hyun and Kim Dae-jung. And so in certain ways, they lost all political leverage in order to move forward. So Moon Jae-in, the new current South Korean president, is not doing that. He's doing it the very first time, very early in his term, with the hopes that he will maintain enough political leverage to push this through before he becomes a lame duck.
What about the substance of this meeting? What do you think Kim and Moon are really trying to achieve here?
It's been fairly well telegraphed. There are going to be three topics. One is going to be what I think is usually the case in these kinds of discussions, sort of North-South dialogue, how North and South can start to reconcile, somehow develop a better relationship. So that would be one part. The second thing will be a peace treaty. There has been a lot of discussion that they're going to make some commitment or intent to end the war. Legally, hostilities has never ceased, and it was replaced by an armistice, which was intended to be temporary. And so they're trying to figure out some way to do this, and it's all been buried using legal reasons as an excuse not to move forward. The most important thing is going to be denuclearization. And I've got a feeling that North Koreans look at denuclearization probably a little bit differently than the United States. I think the North Koreans look at it as a process, phased, something that's going to be over time. I think the United States looks at it as something a lot more immediate. So here we have a significant timing issue. But bigger picture, stepping back over all of this, what the main purpose of this particular summit is for the South Koreans to get a better handle on exactly what Kim Jong-un wants. We've had a lot of conversations with the North Koreans at much lower levels, but the buck stops with Kim Jong-un. And the only American prior to now Secretary of State Pompeo meeting him about last month, before that, the only American who has had any conversation or spent significant amount of time is Dennis Rodman. And so, yes, I feel better that Secretary Pompeo is definitely better than Dennis Rodman, but there's still a lot we don't know about Kim Jong-un specifically. And this is a different time. The big difference, again, is that North Korea now has a credible nuclear deterrent at this point. We don't know how strong it is, but it is there, whereas in prior summits, that did not exist.
How much of this meeting tomorrow is really a preparation for the much-discussed possibility that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un will actually meet for their own summit?
Well, I think there's a significant part of this. Where the rubber meets the road is if there's going to be enough there in terms of what denuclearization means for a summit to happen between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. We have to remember, if we don't figure out a way to relieve these tensions or to get some resolution, to get into a process of trying to resolve the issues, you know, this whole 4 months where tensions have gone down and everyone is talking about peace will go completely away and we'll be right back where we were back 6 months ago when people were tweeting, or Donald Trump was tweeting insults and Kim Jong-un was tweeting reciprocal insults. So that can happen very fast, and that's what's at stake right now.
Philip Yun is the executive director and COO of the Plowshares Fund. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
It's still not clear whether a meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un will actually happen, and if it does, where it would take place. One idea that's been floated is Sweden, because Sweden has a long relationship with North Korea. Tom Henley has the story.
This is Lovisa.
Lovisa Lam Nordenskjöld.
Lovisa is a journalist, but a few years back she was a theater student in Sweden. And one day she was reading this article about North Korea.
It was about how North Korea was almost like a theater play, a staged play.
And this got her thinking. She decided to go and see this real-life play for herself. It was 2008.
It was very strict, the whole thing. I mean, we were 9 tourists, and we had 2 guides who were following us 24/7. I really had the feeling that I was being watched all the time.
One day, Lovisa's group hailed a taxi, and she was shocked to recognize the car that pulled up beside her, a Swedish model from the 70s, a pristine Volvo 144.
The Volvo 144 Grand Lux, one of the fastest Volvos on the road.
Volvo, the car built to get you through the years.
This is Volvo, the Swedish-built compact.
Volvo engineers the car they've got as strongly as possible.
It was a very strange thing to see, because in Sweden we have quite modern cars, but this was like traveling back in time. I mean, it felt like I was in 1974. I mean, the cars were still old. I mean, you could see they were old, but they were very mint condition. They looked well kept.
Lovisa started seeing these Volvos everywhere, and she started wondering how on earth they ended up there, on the streets of Pyongyang.
Pretty quickly, I realized that Sweden had this unique relationship to North Korea.
It seems that in the 70s, left-leaning Sweden was one of the first countries to recognize North Korea as a country in its own right.
We were the first Western country to open up an embassy in North Korea, and for 26 years, we were the only Western embassy in North Korea. So we've had a unique look into North Korea because we've been there in Pyongyang with this embassy for so many years.
I wanted to speak to someone who had been there from the beginning, who could help me understand how these Volvos got there in the first place.
To live in North Korea, it is like being in the Hall of Mirrors. Everything was so odd.
This is Eric Cornell, and it was Eric who opened the first Swedish embassy in Pyongyang and served as its inaugural charge d'affaires from 1975 and 1977. If there is anyone who could explain how all those Volvos ended up in Pyongyang, surely it was Eric.
They had been importing cars from Russia usually, but they have realized that why shall we pay dearly for inferior material when we can buy for a decent price better machines. So they bought 1,000 Volvos, and they bought also slightly less, 700 or 800 Mercedes 220s.
But when Eric says bought, he really means that they signed pieces of paper, because North Korea didn't pay for a single one of those Volvos, or for the Mercedes for that matter. And they still haven't today.
They didn't pay for anything. They signed all these contracts for $800 million or something, and they immediately ran into trouble with paying. They had no idea.
Most of the Volvos went straight into circulation as taxis, but Eric and his wife managed to get one for themselves.
It made it easier to feel at home.
Today, the Swedish government asks annually for the now $360 million debt to be repaid. But this just seems like some kind of formality, a routine they must go through year after year. You see, even if North Korea never pays this debt back, it means that the two countries that have been in dialogue for decades now are still talking to each other. And in a world where the US and most other countries have little, if any, direct contact with North Korea, Sweden could help solve the North Korea question. As Eric puts it, there is a trust between the two countries.
The North Koreans apparently trust us. We always cared a bit for them and we never ridiculized them. Eh?
And with the news that Sweden could serve as the neutral ground for a meeting between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un in the very near future, it seems the story that started with those 1,000 unpaid Volvos is not yet over. For the world, I'm Tom Henley.
Volvo, the car built to get you through the years. And I'm so glad I
stayed. Just ahead, the global reach of our bodies ourselves. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Our bodies ourselves. It's been called the Bible of women's health. But it started out as just a staple booklet put together by a group of women in the Boston area who were sharing their knowledge and experiences about their health and their own bodies. By 1973, Our Bodies Ourselves was a bestseller here in the U.S. Since then, it's been translated into 31 languages and counting. This month, the collective that puts out the book announced that it would no longer publish updated editions. It's a money issue. The World's April Peavy has been looking at the global reach of our bodies ourselves. You know, I remember when this book got pretty popular, I was growing up and would hear a lot about it. It was kind of passed around, and even, you know, friends of my mother's were reading it. It was a big deal. And so I'm really curious about its global reach and who you spoke to about that.
It really is remarkable, the global reach that our bodies ourselves has. And in some ways, it's just as subversive as when the book first came out here. These are issues about women's health that just aren't talked about. So I got in touch with some women who translated the book in just the past 5 to 10 years. And they told me how they interpreted the book for women in their particular countries. Let's hear from a woman who translated the book for women in Uganda.
My name is Diana Namombeja Aboye. Particularly, I found the birth control chapter very informative because there's so many women in Uganda that have unwanted pregnancies. So I felt if there was a way of me bringing this information that would help them prevent these unwanted pregnancies in the first place, that it would change their life all too. So particularly when I read how it discussed the condom use, the fact that there were even female condoms and the IUDs and all these other birth control mechanisms that you could also use without your partner knowing you are having one were very important, because very many women, particularly in marriages, do not have the chance or ability to use birth control with their partners aware they are doing so.
It's really interesting to hear her, because it strikes me that Ugandan women are reading it and they're taking birth control into their own hands, you know, possibly against the wishes of their husband or their local society.
Absolutely. And Diana had also told me that she received her copy as a birthday gift from some of her friends. And there were things that she had never heard about, and this being one of them, the whole idea of birth control. I should say, Carol, too, that there were a couple of things that she couldn't include in her version. One was abortion and one was same-sex relationships, because, as you know, they're both illegal in Uganda.
Which makes it all the more remarkable that this book is being translated for women in Uganda and even getting to them.
All the women I spoke to, they really had to adapt the book for their particular country. So that means that there were some things that were taken out and there were some things that were put in. And that leads me to Samita Das Dasgupta, who translated the book in Bengali for women in West Bengal and Bangladesh. She added a chapter on skin bleaching cream.
The industry is huge. The idea is that your skin will become white, and it's basically a bleaching product. And I included that to kind of make people aware of the issues behind it. That part of it is, of course, that dark skin is beautiful, that kind of a movement, but also the health hazards that are there that crop up as women use a bleaching product on their face and their bodies constantly.
It's really interesting to hear her say that, because it seems to be really challenging a practice that's completely problematic and dangerous. And so it makes me wonder, you know, how people or women are responding when they read about it.
Well, it's interesting. This is where the Our Bodies, Ourselves collective comes in. They have a global initiative, or it's, I guess you could say, a global outreach program, where they work with women like Samita out in the field. In the really rural areas of Bangladesh and West Bengal, many of the women can't read. So it's really up to these field workers and healthcare professionals to go around and talk about what's in the book.
I'm curious who else you talked to.
I spoke to a woman, Dana Weinberg. She's one of the founders of Women and Their Bodies in Israel. She did actually two versions. She did a Hebrew version and an Arabic version. Both versions don't exactly cover the same things. Dana Weinberg says that for the Israeli version, for example, she wanted to talk about the issue of women deciding not to have children, which she says is something that you don't really hear much about in Israel. But here's what she said about the Palestinian version.
We had to choose the issues that are the most silenced issue in the Arabic Palestinian society in Israel, such as abortion and menopause, issues that really was unwritten of. It was very hard to find materials in those issues. If I mentioned the menopause chapter, for example, it was even hard to find words to describe menopause, because in Arabic, the common name is sin el yas, which is the years of despair. Actually, I should add that also in Hebrew, we have a very problematic name to translate menopause. In Hebrew, it's years of being worn out, like a clothes that was worn out too much, gilablut. So both in Arabic and in Hebrew, the name of this stage of women's life represent the cultural and social representation and attitudes towards it.
I'll say. Wow. That's like we're done with you.
Yeah.
Why don't you just wander off? Gee. But what strikes me also immediately is the fact that an Israeli person was involved in the translation of not only the Hebrew edition, but the Arabic edition. I would just think from the politics of the region that the book would immediately be suspect.
Yeah, well, she had mentioned that she really wanted to be culturally sensitive to both groups when she and her group were doing the translations for it. So it was something that she was very much aware of. I asked Dana Weinberg about the kind of reaction that she got from women, and she actually told me about a reaction she got from a man.
A man rabbi, Jewish Orthodox rabbi, who told me not only that he bought the book, he bought it actually for his wife, but when he started reading it, it became very clear to him how little he knows about women's health, about women's sexuality, about women's needs and challenges regarding their body. Now the book is on his desk, on his working desk. He uses it as a conversation starter. Every time a woman comes and wants to talk about issues regarding contraceptive or ministerial issues and Judaism. So this was very moving for me because, you know, he was not the person that we thought we are targeting, yet it was very moving for us to understand how far we could have reached with our writing.
This is interesting because I think in many ways that's the arc of the impact of Our Bodies, Ourselves in the U.S. I mean, most American men, even American doctors and OBGYN, they don't know much about women's health or women's sexuality. And the same kind of gradual understanding and acceptance of that as an important subject, that gradually took place here.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
Now, I know you mentioned that there won't be any updated editions of Our Bodies, Ourselves here in the U.S., but I'm wondering what other translations are in the works.
Well, right now they still have current projects underway, Morocco, Mongolia, and Indonesia. And yes, it will continue to be published. It will be available online, and it will continue to be read by women not only here in the United States, but all around the globe.
Thanks, April.
Thanks, Carol.
The world's April Peavy. I'm Carol Hills. In some countries, content posted on Facebook has led to real-life violence. The company admits it's been too slow to take that content down. Case in point, a video that caused riots in Sri Lanka.
This video that contributed to violence all over the country is still up.
Facebook's global problem with hateful content, just ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here's a point Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has found himself making over and over again in recent weeks.
For most of our existence, we've focused on all the good that connecting people can bring. But it's clear now we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well.
That was Zuckerberg during a call with investors yesterday. He told them his company has had yet another quarter of record earnings. That might come as a surprise if you've been following the controversies Facebook has been embroiled in the past year. Controversies involving bad actors using the platform, as Zuckerberg put it, to cause harm. Physical harm, in some cases, not online, but in the real world. That's been happening in several countries outside of the U.S., like Sri Lanka, where Facebook has been used by extremists to spread fake news, propaganda, and disinformation. That's an issue you've heard about on our show before, but a new investigative report by the New York Times takes it one step further. It tracks how viral posts on Facebook can lead to deadly violence in real life. Amanda Taub co-reported the story titled, Where Countries Are Tinderboxes and Facebook is a Match. Amanda, first, remind us how big Facebook is in a country like Sri Lanka.
So Facebook in Sri Lanka is kind of the internet, the newspaper, the TV, all in one. One family who we visited during the course of our reporting, their house is about as isolated as it's possible to be. You go to the end of the road, and then you go on this dirt track up a mountain. And then when you get up to the end of the dirt track on the mountain, you take this steep little path that's only wide enough for one person down to their house, which doesn't have running water, but it has Facebook. Everybody there has Facebook.
In your reporting, you tell the story of a Muslim restaurant owner in Sri Lanka and how a misunderstanding that played out on social media escalated into violence. Tell us about that.
So what happened was, in a town called Ampara, one evening things were, as far as this restaurant owner knew, a very normal night, but his customers began to yell at him about something they had found in their food. He couldn't really understand what was going on because he speaks Tamil, which is a minority language in Sri Lanka, and his customers were shouting in Sinhala, which is the language of the Sinhalese Buddhist majority there. But it turned out that what they were talking about was a rumor that they had heard on Facebook that Muslim shop and restaurant owners were slipping so-called sterilization pills into the food of their Sinhalese customers in an attempt to sterilize them and wipe out the race. There had been a viral post on Facebook just the day before saying that a huge number of pills had been seized by police in Ampara. And his customer had found a small lump of flour in his plate of roti and beef curry and was convinced that this was one of these sterilization pills.
So this restaurant customer starts to ask the Muslim restaurant owner in right. Sinhala about this.
So he started to shout at him, and that drew a crowd. One of the crowd pulled out a cell phone and started to videotape the encounter. And you can hear people shouting at the restaurant owner to admit it, admit that he put these pills in the food. He couldn't understand what they were saying. So he just kind of said yes, because he was trying to defuse the situation. And to the crowd, that was confirmation that these rumors were true, that here was a Muslim restaurant owner admitting that he was trying to sterilize Sinhalese people. So then two things happened. A mob gathered and attacked this restaurant, beat the owner extremely severely, and then moved on and attacked the town's mosque and some other Muslim-owned homes.
So in a case like this, you have this viral incendiary charge against Muslims in Sri Lanka. It's taken out on this Muslim restaurant owner, and there's nothing that's done to dispel the rumor or to correct the impression of what's going on.
Right. So in fact, the opposite happened in this case. This video of the restaurant owner in Ampara was uploaded to Facebook, where it started to be shared by some pages run by extremists who are kind of extreme Buddhist nationalists and had been whipping up hatred against Muslims in Sri Lanka for a long time. And they shared it as, you know, here is proof of these rumors, here is proof of this conspiracy we've been telling you about. And at that point, it provoked violence nationwide that killed at least one person and destroyed many more homes and businesses. And there was nothing that could push back against the rumors. So the government tried to get ahead of them, but they couldn't. They debunked the sterilization pills, which of course don't exist. There's no such thing as a sterilization pill. But by then, so many people had heard the story that it had taken on a life of its own.
And some of that has to do with Facebook's own algorithm, which really doesn't help at all in these situations because, as you write, it unintentionally privileges negativity.
Right. So Facebook's algorithm is part of their platform. It's designed to promote posts that will get the most user engagement, which basically just means the posts that will be most popular. But it turns out that the things that get the most user engagement are the things that provoke negative emotions like outrage and fear. So when you see something on Facebook where somebody is kind of decrying an injustice that has been committed against your group, those are the posts that get the most clicks. They're the posts that get the most shares. And so then the algorithm boosts them even further. Whereas, you know, something like the government debunking one of these rumors, it doesn't have that same effect and it doesn't get that same boost because it just doesn't have the same emotional appeal to people.
And this kind of situation where a viral incendiary post on Facebook sparks violence, it isn't only a problem in Sri Lanka. What other countries have we seen viral content escalate to violence?
So we've been tracking a series of cases all over the world, really. We have cases in Mexico, in Indonesia, India, Kenya, South Africa, Nigeria. What we're finding is the more that we dig into countries where social media is new and where it has kind of quickly taken hold, as it has in Sri Lanka, and managed to kind of outrun local institutions, it has often had this effect of spurring violence. You know, the most extreme case of this is, of course, Myanmar, where online hatred against the Rohingya and Muslims generally created the environment that contributed to and enabled the ethnic cleansing that has been happening there.
What is Facebook doing to address this issue?
Facebook is aware of this problem now, but they have a couple of big problems when it comes to countries like Sri Lanka. The biggest one is that their content moderation system, which, you know, Facebook's own rules say that this kind of content is not allowed. You're not allowed to post hate speech. You're not allowed to post incitements to violence. But they don't have enough moderation tools, either human or computer-based, to actually filter out this content. So Facebook has acknowledged to government officials and activists in Sri Lanka that they just don't have enough moderators in the Sinhalese language to actually evaluate posts like this and take them down.
What do you think Facebook sees as its role and responsibility as it expands into markets in the developing world?
That is difficult to tell. I wouldn't want to speak for Facebook on this, and they haven't given us a statement about it. But it seems that they have been focused on quickly saturating these markets, to getting their next billion users, and becoming an indispensable resource and almost like a public utility in these countries. But they haven't put as much thought into what responsibilities that creates. They haven't put in as much thought to doing things like preventing violence, which I think is pretty clear from the track record of the government and local civil society activists' attempts in Sri Lanka to reach out to Facebook. They have been trying for years in some cases to warn Facebook that this was coming, to warn them that their platform was integral to a problem that was going to lead to violence, and they just couldn't get anyone's attention.
Amanda, what happened in the end to the Muslim restaurant owner and to the viral post?
The viral post, at last time I checked, which was a couple of days ago, is still online. It hasn't been taken down. And the posts that it spurred as well, most of them are still up as well. And the restaurant owner who we spoke to is in hiding. He's had to move to a nearby town. He shaved his beard because people kept recognizing him and coming up and saying, "You're from the video." And that made him feel uncomfortable and sometimes even scared. And the thing that we found most remarkable about our conversations with him is that the thing he's doing to fill his days now that he has, you know, he's lost his livelihood, his future is in jeopardy, is he's reading Facebook. He said he has more time for it than ever. You know, he has firsthand experience of how destructive fake news and false rumors on Facebook can be. You know, they nearly got him killed and they destroyed his family's livelihood. But he still reads it. He said, whether it's right or wrong, it's what I read.
Amazing. Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks so much.
Amanda Taub with the New York Times. During that interview, you heard Taub say that activists in Sri Lanka and other countries have been pleading with Facebook to do more to step in before posts escalate to violence.
It's about 4 years since we've been communicating to them concerns around the content that we've been monitoring. All our pleas, our requests have been met with silence.
What we've been asking for Facebook is to have someone who can actually engage with us so that we can help them improve their product.
We'll hear more from those two activists tomorrow on The World. Time for some music. Here's both an A-side and a B-side from The World's Brandy Fullwood.
In this A-side, B-side, I'm comparing these two songs that layer and punctuate in ways that deviate from the established rhythm. This is Belle Mama, or Call Mama, by Moang African Ensemble. Right at the beginning, the strings sway into the drums and then dip into shakers. Eventually, a round of drums fold in. The smooth melody becomes this shoulder-shaking beat. Belle Mama, oh Belle Mama, eh. Belle Mama, oh Belle Mama, eh. It's repetitive, and you get accustomed to it initially, and if you groove right into it from the start, there's a warm-bellied trot that lifts the body up, gliding and shifting. Ballet Mama by Mwang African Ensemble eventually breaks out into this harmony. In the midst of it, the lead singer leaves the harmony and begins highlighting, punctuating the structure he just handed over to the group. He riffs on his own a bit. It's a sudden burst of joy. And it makes sense. The Cameroonian folk song Ballet Mama, or Call Mama, is meant to be a song that calls out to one's mother and asks her to dance, to celebrate. I know my own mother too well, and she'd just get right up and dance. But in a moment of stress, it can be difficult to convince her or anyone to drop everything and dance. And that's what I imagine here, a reluctant mother not ready to dance. It's not just any old call, but one that entices. The B-side. Blue from the Dark comes from Kate LeBon and Tim Presley's musical Outfit called Drinks. Blue from the Dark is the opening track on their album Hippolyte. Each texture builds in like digging through damp sand. It's slow, steady, and disrupted by jangle and jagged pieces. Initially, there's this light plucking with a piano that follows behind it. It may take a few listens to hear the fuzz peeking under the sound bed, the stuttering piano, the way the strings aren't exactly smooth but falter now and then. But it's there. So, unlike the A-side, neither of them lead in quite the same way as the singer in the ensemble does. Instead, their voices collide. Presley's light vintage croon with LeBon's icy soprano falsetto. It's almost sung in a register where they would need one another for this to work, even though they contribute wonderful tone on their own. The punctuating and highlighting on this B-side is due in large part to the added sound textures. Over the course of the song, they stretch out and layer in piece by piece. At first, they're characterized as unique instruments, but as Blue from the Dark drifts into its conclusion, the sounds collide into a busy intersection. For the world, I'm Brandy Fullwood.
Climb in a chain. How you gonna take the blue from the dark? Caution, out on a limb. How you gonna take the blue from the
Coming up, incels, chads, and Stacey's. Stick around to find out what I'm talking about. You're with the world.
Love grips for centuries. How you gonna take the blue from the dark? Wind break, hands in the plane. How you gonna take the blue from the dark?
On Monday, authorities say, 25-year-old Alec Manassian used a van to strike pedestrians on a busy street in downtown Toronto. 10 people were killed and more than a dozen injured. Soon after Manassian was arrested, journalists found his now-deleted Facebook page. One of his recent posts called for the Incel Rebellion. It's a reference to a dark corner of the internet that's infamous for its misogyny and calls for violence. Archie Mann is with the Daily Extra in Toronto. He's been reporting on incels and similar online groups.
Incel stands for involuntary celibate. It's a kind of anti-feminist subculture that's developed online, one amongst many that's kind of popped up on the internet over the last 20 years. What kind of distinguishes incels from some of these other groups, such as, say, pickup artists, men's rights activists, red pillars, there's a variety of them. But incels are probably the most virulently misogynist of any of these subcultures. They gather in a variety of online spaces and engage in this kind of really violent ideation towards women. So essentially, they believe that they are entitled to sex, they're entitled to women's bodies, and women who deny them that are the problem. It really is kind of one of the more terrifying corners of the internet. And unfortunately, I think we've seen some of that leak into the real world this week.
They have certain terms, Stacey's and Chad's. What do they mean?
So like a lot of these subcultures, they kind of have their own lingo. So Stacey's refers to women that they find sexually attractive, but are very kind of distant from them. They're unattainable. Whereas Chad's are what you might think of as jocks or attractive men who have sex with the women that they desire. The kind of effect of these sorts of terms, and they have many others, really prominent amongst them is femoid, a way to refer to women as essentially robots. The effect of all of this is to dehumanize people around them and to kind of treat them as if they aren't actually people. That's always dangerous because it's kind of a necessary precursor to violence.
How many people are we talking about? Are we talking about, 50 men making lots of noise and saying horrific things? Or are we talking thousands? Is there any way to really know?
The broader community is certainly in the tens of thousands at the very least. So a good indication of this is when Reddit shut down the incels subreddit last year for engaging in threats and a lot of different kinds of violent and abusive behaviors, it had around 40,000 subscribers. And that was only one part of the kind of online incel world. So they have other forums, there are other subreddits. A lot of them are also on 4chan, especially the R9K board. Within the Anglosphere, it's quite common, I would say. Certainly in Australia, Canada, the UK, the United States, you have a lot of people talking about being incels. A lot of them are partaking in this kind of, violent imaginings, not all of them. But certainly, that culture of violence, the deification of violence and that misogyny are not only tolerated, but celebrated by these communities as a whole.
Incel subculture, it's one of several groups online made up of young men with grievances against women. But how does incel ideology compare to the ideologies of other groups like the Red Pill or men's rights activists?
So you kind of have to trace the different origins of these groups and how they branched off from each other, metastasized, fight against each other. A good place to start would probably be the pickup artists, which really became an organized online community about 20 years ago. And over the next many years, you had more kind of virulent forms of anti-feminism develop. So the pickup artists mostly wanted to use kind of social psychology tricks and techniques to try and pick up and, hit on women. But that eventually merged with a kind of anti-feminism. It became much more explicit, say, with red pill culture. In red pill culture, it's not only trying to tell you how to pick up women, but it's also fusing it with much more explicit ideas around the superiority of men. Incels often start off within that pickup artist or red pill kind of world. They try to adopt these tips and tricks and these ideologies to essentially be sexually successful. And for some of them, when it fails, they get very angry. So they get angry at the men who are peddling these systems, and they really start to direct their anger towards women. They want women to kind of feel the pain or frustration that they feel that they're experiencing. It really is a process of radicalization.
course, a really terrifying event was when a lot of people first heard about incels. Back in 2014, 22-year-old Elliot Roger killed 6 people and injured about a dozen more at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And before his shooting spree, he recorded a video about his motivations and released a manifesto. And he's become a kind of martyr to the incel community, right?
Not just a martyr, but almost a kind of demigod. They really do talk a lot about Elliot Roger. They venerate the kind of violence that he perpetrated. And the murders in Isla Vista were really a turning point, I think, for the almost politicization of this online community. Because of the fact that Roger had a manifesto, it was about 100,000 words long, and it was really filled with his vitriol against women. He also left a YouTube video explaining his motivations for the murders. That became a pivotal moment. They were trying to push each other to almost replicate that. They talk a lot about trying to do the same kinds of things as Elliot Roger did. And you can see that in that Facebook post that Alec Manassian, the man who's now accused of killing 10 people in the Toronto van attack, he referenced specifically Elliot Roger. A lot of this incel language that we were talking about earlier, Stacey's, Chad's, it talks about Elliot Roger.
How about the incel groups themselves? How have they responded to Monday's attack?
So there's been a variety of different kind of reactions within these groups. Some of them are a little bit worried about the mainstream attention that they're getting. Others are celebrating Manassian's actions. They're starting to venerate him in the same way that they venerate Elliot Roger. You know, I think I saw one post saying that they should celebrate the day in April where Manassian committed this act as St. Manassian's feast. That's the kind of veneration they give to people who perpetrate this kind of misogynistic violence. Other folks are trying to do this kind of not all incels act. And, you know, they're right. Not every incel engages in acts of violence. But almost every incel who participates in this community does either condone or allow this culture of violence to continue. I think there's a lot of value in looking at ways in which we can minimize the spaces in which these extreme misogynists are able to radicalize each other and bring on new recruits.
Arshi Mann is a reporter for The Daily Extra, an LGBT-focused online magazine in Toronto. Thanks, Arshi.
Thank you very much.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.